When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, fellow time travelers. Great to have you with me again as we travel around the world through time and space. It's a lonely business. I would prefer to have as many of you with me as possible. So hopefully there's quite a gang by now. Before I get started, thanks again to everyone who's signed up to my Patreon site. It's the financial support drawn from the patreon.com presence that makes everything else possible. If you're not a member of Patreon and you want to become a member, go to patreon.com, look for me by name, Neil Oliver. Part with some cash, do it monthly or do it annually. It is a bit cheaper if you go for a year all at once. You get two exclusive vodcasts every week, quizzes, prizes, chats. Paul and I come up with various developments and extensions that we can add to the site all the time. Maybe best of all, though, you become part of a community, a family, I would prefer to think of it. Free-thinking time travellers, people with questions they want answered. And it's an opportunity to get in amongst like minds and share ideas. Okay, it's time to strap ourselves, yourselves, into the time machine as we set off on another episode of My Love Letter to the World. Recorder, microphone, action. When they sense the exhaustion, they can smell it like blood in the water, and they capitalise on it. The king is toppled and the republic rises. People power propels the empire forward, ever more muscular as it expands in all directions. After centuries of growth, Rome rules great swathes of Asia, Africa, and the European continent. Onto the stage steps a military commander of genius who has already grown rich and powerful in the province of Gaul. Crossing the Rubicon, he takes on the Republican elite. He claims Cleopatra as a lover and sweeps to victory, bringing totalitarianism to Rome. Endeavouring to understand history in hopes of illuminating the future, I'm Neil Oliver and this is my love letter to the world.
Hi Neil. In the last episode in 210 BC, we walked with a mighty army of incredible terracotta soldiers as the first emperor of China was laid to rest. Where are we this week?
Afternoon, Paul. We're stepping forward in time, the best part of a couple of centuries, as one of the world's greatest empires reaches a decisive moment in its history. The Roman Republic has been powerful and prosperous for hundreds of years, but now it comes face to face with one of its own. We're on the banks of the river Rubicon as Caesar rolls the dice. The moment in question, the moment in the story of the world, is Julius Caesar crossing the Rubicon. And obviously crossing the Rubicon is one of those expressions that so many people use, but probably not everyone, by any stretch, will know where it comes from. But we're going to get to that, and we'll see the historical origin of crossing the Rubicon. But before that, before we can consider Julius Caesar and what his impact was on Rome, it's important to tee this one up by thinking about totalitarianism, how this keeps happening to societies and to civilizations. you know, whatever egalitarian backgrounds or periods or phases a population or a civilization goes through, if they go through that, there's almost an irresistible pull towards totalitarianism. It's like a dark black hole centre of gravity that's always there. Whatever people try to do in terms of equality and democracy and caring, sharing, entropy gets into the system or is in the system, and everyone gets too exhausted in it, and someone takes that society by the scruff of the neck as a dictator of some sort, and the whole thing, all the power centralises. People have studied it. Political philosophers and the like have studied how this happens over and over again. The principle of anacyclosis, you know, the idea you go from something benevolent to something corrupt and totalitarian, and then you get back to something nice again. Well, one of those who contemplated how this, you know, I refer all the time to Eric Hoffer, The True Believer, and this is a book about how mass movements get going. And so he deals with how totalitarians and authoritarians periodically get a grip of society and make people do what they want. And another writer of note was Hannah Arendt. She was a Holocaust survivor. She went into and came out the other side of the camps in the 20th century under the Third Reich. And then after that, she became a political philosopher. And she was a witness to, not in the legal sense, she was there to watch the trial of Adolf Eichmann. And Eichmann was one of the high-ups in the Third Reich. He was an administrator. He was an organiser of the genocide of the Jewish people. He was the one that looked after the logistics and made it possible, made it happen. You know, when you think about the scale of that operation, moving hundreds of thousands and then millions of people around with the express intention of killing them. So Adolf Eichmann was captured after the war and went on trial. And Hannah Arendt watched the trial, and she famously wrote about the banality of evil. Actually, it got to the point in the aftermath of what she wrote that she was being accused of almost being an apologist for Eichmann, because she described the way in which anyone, in a sense, could become part of something like a genocide just by becoming an administrator, a coordinator, and ceasing to see the human element of what was involved. There was a lot of controversy around it, but anyway, the banality of evil, everyone's heard about it. But Hannah Arendt wrote about how, within the context of all of that, she wrote about how totalitarianism, it begins with mass contempt for society as it is. People get tired of the status quo, and an idea appears almost overnight, almost like a mushroom. This idea appears that we've got to have change. Things must change, no matter what. It doesn't really matter what, as long as we get change, as long as we get something else. Anything's better than what we have right now. And so in that atmosphere, would-be totalitarian rulers, they sense the zeitgeist and they organise the sentiment, this desire for change, and they articulate it. You know, they give speeches and they put into words a possible utopian future, and the people, or enough of the people, come to love it. And before you know where you are, you've got a mass movement moving towards something like communism or the Third Reich. This is how these things are done. And at the moment, right now, the trust in leaders is failing all over. You know, there are leaders who are under attack, metaphorically speaking, for what they've been up to in recent times. You know, you think about Justin Trudeau in Canada and Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand and Emmanuel Macron in France and others besides. People are fed up. Not everyone, but in a lot of societies. Right now, this week, Giorgia Meloni in Italy has sensed a desire for some kind of change. So there's a period of flux and a desire for change is out there. And trust in a lot of leaders who've been around for a while is guttering, you know, like a candle flame that's, you know, starting to drown in its own wax. You can see these these lights just about to go out. And so there's calls for change all over the place. So it's interesting in the context of looking at the past, it's interesting to note that some of the same elements, ingredients for change are here now. They're here now in the West. Society's getting exhausted with itself, and confidence in the way things have been, the way things used to be, it's on the wane, and it's an interesting and a dangerous time. Let's now get into the historical context of Julius Caesar. We've spoken previously about when Rome got rid of its last king. There had been a monarchy in Rome, but they got sick of them because they were corrupt and more corrupt, and eventually they drove the last king of Rome away with all his family. And Rome became a republic, res publica, you know, the business of the people, and the onus on running society came to the individual and the collective people. Democracy, in whatever form, people managing their own affairs. And what evolved in Rome in the aftermath of the kings, the Republic took the form of rule by the Senate. You know, and the Senate was like a parliament, like a coming together of figures who would make decisions. And above the Senate, there were two consuls who were elected annually. And these were men who were experienced, military men, older men, you know, who'd seen life, who'd run provinces, who had governed and commanded armies and whatever. There would be two consuls for a year. Underneath them there was the Senate, and beneath the Senate there was a complicated and really quite an intricate system of government evolved, with to some extent checks and balances, mechanisms in place to try and stop any one individual or any group of individuals taking power and holding power for too long. Everything had a best before date on it, you know, a use by date after which those individuals would be replaced. And under that republic, the shadow of Rome started to spread over more and more of Europe and the old world. The system worked because, at heart, Rome wasn't too fussy about trying to micromanage every moment of every street and every field and every house that was falling under its shadow. Broadly speaking, if the provinces and the people thereof paid their taxes, sent gold back to Rome when requested, when required, and if they sent men to serve time in the legions, they were pretty much left to get on with things as they wanted. So Rome wasn't trying to impose stark uniformity. There was leeway as long as people did certain things. Pay your taxes, send men, you know, offer up slaves, that kind of thing, and you'd be left to get on with it. There was a neighbouring empire, run from Carthage in what is now Tunisia in North Africa. This was an empire that had been sort of ceded and had been left behind by the Phoenicians. And we've looked at the Phoenicians before. They built the first temple for Solomon in Jerusalem. They were great traders, great travellers, great architects and builders. And by the by the middle of the 3rd century, before the birth of Christ, Rome and Carthage, Rome and that Phoenician empire, were kind of bumping up against one another unhappily, vying for overall control of the Mediterranean world. And eventually war broke out, and war happened and dragged on intermittently, with pauses in between, for 100 years. The Roman rendering of Phoenician was Punic. So this period of conflict became known as has gone down in history as the Punic Wars. And the Punic reference to the Punic Wars is a sort of a byword for anything that lasts interminably. You know, such and such lasted longer than the Punic Wars, a person might joke. And so it ground on and on and on. And then by, I think the official date is 146 years before the birth of Christ, there was a final defeat and invasion of Carthage by Rome. And the Romans went the lengths of ploughing salt into the soil of the fields so that the place was sterile, barren for a generation. Carthage would never be Carthage again. And so from that point on, Rome had added Africa, or a chunk of Africa, to its empire. Also by that time, the Greek city-states, as had been, were also under Rome. France, France was Gaul. Spain, much of Spain was under Roman rule. Parts of Asia, by the 1st century BC, the shadow of Rome stretched all the way to the Black Sea. This was all happening under the Republic.
So it lasted a long time, and...
Yes, the Republic lasted for centuries. Once it got up and running, it worked. Is the truth of it, the undeniable fact of it, obviously, you know, the glory that was Rome, it worked. And it threw up these iconic figures like Marius and Sulla and Pompey, great leaders of men, some of the first name gang, you know, some of the people that just go down in history with only one name, you know, like Beyonce. So you've got these figures, and then comes the daddy, Julius Caesar. He's a nephew of Marius's wife. When he comes in, when the spotlight turns on him, that's all anybody knows about him, you would say. And he gets a shot at being consul. In 59 years BC, Julius Caesar gets to be one of the consuls, one of the two people in charge of the Senate. That period of consulship, I think that's a word, is followed by 7 years in command of the army of Gaul, what we know as France. He is a military tactician of genius. I think it's fair to say that some people say that if Caesar isn't the greatest military mind of all time, he's definitely in the top one. You know, he was of unequalled ability. And he was expected back in Rome and didn't come for a long time. He stayed put. He stayed in Gaul in command of his army. He was enjoying the fame and he was enjoying the wealth and the power. But then eventually... the gravity of Rome, he had to go back. Now, there was a way in which he would have been expected to come back to Rome. Custom dictated a certain behaviour. And as he left Gaul and came into northeastern Italy, there's a river, and it was known then as the Rubicon. And the etiquette was that a commander, like Julius Caesar, on arrival on the far bank of the Rubicon, would surrender the command of his army, kind of retire his command, and would then complete his approach to Rome under those circumstances. Almost like he'd hung up his guns, you know, almost like he checked his firearms at the door with the bouncers. But he didn't do that. He crossed the Rubicon at the head of his army. So that's what crossing the Rubicon means, because once he splashed ashore on the near side, if you like, there was no going back. He had crossed the Rubicon, and he had set in sequence events which would just have to play out now. And the moment, in terms of the story of the world, is that he apparently said, barely overheard, possibly more for himself than for anybody else, "The die is cast. You know, I've rolled the dice now. This is it." Interestingly enough, no one's quite sure now which river in the northeast of Italy was the one that the Romans were calling the Rubicon. At some point during his reign as dictator, Benito Mussolini, decided that it was a river running through a town called Savignano, and so that's become Savignano sul Rubicon. But the point was that by crossing the Rubicon at the head of his army, Julius Caesar had committed treason, high treason. Ultimately, you know, he could have been captured, tried and executed for what he had done, for what he was doing, because he was approaching Rome as a threat, and word spread. Rome knew he was coming at the head of his army, you know, shock and horror. But he said, you know, on the contrary, what he was doing was to save the Republic from ambitious and corrupt men. He said, in his own defence, that he had justification. He was coming to preserve and to save the Republic. Pompey, the aforementioned Pompey, was sent to deal with him. Pompey was another great general, a great commander with successes behind him. Caesar outfought him and outthought him every step of the way, eventually chased him all the way to Egypt, and Pompey was murdered in Egypt. And that was it. At this point, Julius Caesar is hard to challenge. He has asserted his dominance. It was at that time, famously, that he got together with Cleopatra, the pharaoh, the queen of Egypt. He got together with her, although some people speculate that actually the prime mover in that in that assignation was Cleopatra herself. But there we are. It's now 45 years before the birth of Christ. It's just 4 years since he crossed the Rubicon, and he's voted dictator for life. Julius Caesar is awarded a hitherto sort of unthought of title, I suppose, dictator for life. He's king of Rome in all but name. After all the centuries of republic, in every way that matters, Rome's got a king again, and it's Julius Caesar. So this is how totalitarianism comes, when too many people decide, accept, I don't know, possibly do no more than drop their shoulders as though tired of what they have. It no longer means anything to them. Whatever inherent value their society's structure and meaning had, it's gone. People just let it go because they want something new. And when someone charismatic offers the something new in the way that Julius Caesar did, well, it turns out people sometimes go along with it. It's fair to say, though, that Caesar didn't kill the Republic of Rome. The Republic was dying. The Republic was bleeding from 1,000 cuts anyway. Because people were exhausted by it. But having said that, he was murdered. Caesar was murdered on the floor of the Senate, famously, on the 15th of March, the Ides of March, 44 BC. And then the people, Brutus and the rest of them that conspired and did the deed, they were, you know, those with blood on their hands were soon chased down and killed anyway. But the bigger point really is that as Kenneth Clarke, who I've referenced before, not the MP, but the art critic and historian Kenneth Clarke, said that civilization collapses in itself because of exhaustion and loss of confidence. A people, a population, loses confidence in its society, in its philosophy, its laws, everything. Everything is suddenly unsatisfactory, and anything new is what's desired. So when Caesar crossed the Rubicon, he said, the die is cast. That was the moment in the story of the world. And the die was cast. Everything was different now. After Caesar, you get his adopted great-nephew, Octavian. And he finishes the job. He finishes the job of doing away with the Republic without actually saying that he was doing away with the Republic. That's what happened. The structures, SPQR, Senatus Populus Cui Romanus, you know, the Senate and the people of Rome, that SPQR, that acronym that appears everywhere, all of that was still in place. And there was a myth perpetuated that Rome was still a republic, but it wasn't. It was an empire under an emperor. Octavian, he proved his mettle. He was challenged quickly by Cleopatra, who by then was in partnership with another Roman, Mark Antony, and they took on Octavian. But they were both dead by 30 years BC, and that was all over. Octavian became consul in 27 BC. He was awarded, or he took the honorific Augustus, which means venerable. So he becomes Caesar Augustus. He takes he keeps the family name. Then he takes on Pontifex Maximus, which means the greatest priest. So that he even politicized the religion. That had been a religious title, Pontifex Maximus, but Octavian took it as part of his own personal collection of titles and honours. And that was the next phase of the glory of Rome would unfold under Octavian. And it's, again, to come back to the present, it's important to contemplate what tends to happen, or what has happened before, when enough people regard the present with contempt and contemplate change for the sake of change. You know, look back at Rome, look back at the Republic, when men of ambition, men like Caesar, men like Octavian, when they sense the exhaustion, they can smell it like blood in the water or smoke in the air from a distant fire, and they capitalize on it, and suddenly everything is different. But suffice it to say, when Caesar crossed the Rubicon and rolled the dice, he was starting the next phase of the story of Rome. and in the years to come, Romans would learn to love it. The struggle between stability, chaos, and new order is a constant story. The choice, submitting or resisting, between kneeling or standing. There are always men who would be king, unreasonable men who would remake the world in their own image. There are always people who will not submit even when all is lost. Whatever happens, we may refuse our consent. Next time in my love letter to the world. To help support this podcast and to get access to new and exclusive history and comment vodcasts every week, sign up to my Neil Oliver Patreon site. It'd be great to see you there. Check out the Instagram account called Neil Oliver Love Letter. My YouTube channel is simply called the Neil Oliver Channel. And to help build this podcast, please tell your friends about it. Get them listening and write a review to convince the online crowd that they should join us. For further reading about these moments in time, you could try my book. It's called The Story of the World in 100 Moments, and it's published by Transworld. Neil Oliver's Love Letter to the World is produced by Paul Ratcliffe and Neil Oliver for Catnip Inc. Music is composed by Milo McKinnon. Social media and YouTube producer is Oscar CFR. Additional research is by Evie, Lucian, Archie and Teddy. Finance is by Catherine and Trudy. Post-production is by Althorpe Studios and the graphics are by Paul Plowman. Thanks for listening. This has been a Catnip Inc. podcasts production.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.